This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
We're going to take turns speaking, and then we'll probably interrupt each other some. We hope that doesn't get too inchoate. So we'll start with just another little bit of introduction about what we've been doing. So I know I no longer teach at this prison, but I did go in on the average twice a month for 4 years. It's the correctional training facility right on Highway 101, just north of Soledad in Monterey County. It's a hike to get there. Most of the places I've lived, I have moved around some. It's been between 94 and 100 miles drive each way. Going down there in rush hour traffic is a bear. Coming back late at night is a relative a breeze. It'd be a 7-hour day in order, counting the driving back and forth, to be there for there at the prison for 2 hours, plus whatever time we would spend ahead of time preparing a talk. So going down there is like, I kind of don't want to do it. The drive seems onerous. And then it's a prison. But I've signed up for it. It's got to go. And coming back, it always felt like the best thing I'd ever done. It was exhilarating. I'll talk more about why later. So again, I did it for 4 years and don't any longer. I recruited this fellow, Phil, who is still doing it. So in a way, I'm still going. I feel like Phil. Would you like to say something?
Happy to carry on your legacy, Bill. The men remember you. Sometimes they ask about you. I don't know if I've told you that before, but yeah. Is Bill coming back? It is quite a commitment. I have some of the same feelings that that Bill has expressed. You drive for many hours, and you get there, and then you're at a prison. This is not a nice place to be, and I occasionally ask myself, why did I sign up for this? And it is a little bit difficult, I think, as with many things in life, the anticipation is worse than the actual experience. We drive, usually because of rush hour, we drive for 3 hours. We'll meet up usually with another volunteer somewhere along the way, and we go in pairs, and we'll kind of plan an agenda in the car on the way in. So it's always a little bit ad hoc. Someone has prepared a talk beforehand, and then we'll talk about what kinds of things we want to do with the men. The program is a little bit flexible, but it generally contains some of these elements. We always do a meditation at the beginning. Sometimes we'll do check-ins after that, where we go around and check in with the men, or do a round of introductions if there are some new men. We'll do a talk for maybe half an hour or 40 minutes. Then sometimes we'll do a Q&A after that. Sometimes we'll do some movement, where we'll do some Qigong or some walking meditation. So we plan that out in the car. And we get to the prison. One of the buildings has a cornerstone that says 1954. I think it has a kind of a 1930s feel to it. And there's big fences with razor wire coiled at the top, and interestingly, lots of plastic bags have blown up against the fences over the years, and so there's this sort of a little bit of a desolate feel there. It's very windy in the valley there. And we go and we go through a metal detector, which has now been deactivated, so the security level varies kind of widely over time. There are rules, and then there are COs and CO opinions, and we generally, by consent, go along with CO opinions, which conform more or less to some set of rules that have existed at some point in time over the years. They generally search through our stuff. They have us sign in. They take away our driver's license and give us another card we use to get in. We go through a couple of sally ports, which are our rooms, where there are two doors, and the rule is both doors can never be open at the same time. So you go into the room and a door closes and locks behind you, and then a door opens in front of you and you can go through. And usually one or both of the doors is heavy and metal bars. And after a little bit of walking, we arrive in kind of this big, long hallway. The experience kind of reminds me of a cross between my old high school and airport security. The guards at our prison, the COs, correctional officers, are they're very cooperative with us. They're very polite. And that is a big treat. That is not the experience, not a universal experience anyway, of people who volunteer in prisons in California. So yeah, we have a lot to be grateful for in that. We go in and we have little metal chits. Actually, I have mine with me, if I can get them out. So these little discs, copper or brass or something, with our names on them, and we exchange these for alarms, which look like garage door openers and are extremely sensitive. And if you accidentally touch one or on purpose touch it, an alarm will go off and the bells ring and all the prisoners get down on the floor, and it's very dramatic, and you don't want that to happen. And then you get keys to open up the chapel where we go in. It's a room about this size. It's all cinder blocks. It's painted this color, but you know, the paint's not as nice. And linoleum floors, big wooden pews with towels on the feet, wrapped around the feet so that they can be slid around. And we go in and we start our meditation. The men kind of filter in our... all right, that's your part. It's Bill's turn now.
We did meet twice to plan this, but only twice. But one thing we said, feel free to interrupt each other.
You did a good job.
Okay. So I was going to talk about like what we actually do. But first I want to tag on to something you said, Phil, about that hallway. So we check in at the main gate and then walk through a gate that passes underneath the barbed wire fence, razor wire fence, and then through a courtyard to the Sallyport, through the two gates of the Sallyport, as Phil described, and then we're inside the main prison building, and there's a rather long hallway that we walk down to get to the chapel, and we always arrived at around 6:20, more or less, which is just when shifts of the inmates are going to, are getting out of chow. And the chow hall is right across from where we enter. So we're walking down the hallway to the chapel from the Sallyport at the same time that dozens or sometimes hundreds of inmates are also walking down the hall. So there's just the inmates and the two volunteers and maybe about four correctional officers inside the hallway. So we're outnumbered. And sometimes it's a little bit of a delicious feeling. Oh, am I fearful? So that's where this practice comes in handy, just noting emotions. But usually it's actually kind of great. Every once in a while, mostly the inmates don't pay any attention to us, or they even avert their eyes. But every once in a while, someone would look at me, and I'd nod in a nice way, and the inmate would nod in a nice way. Someone that doesn't come to the meditation group. And it was, I kind of liked that mutual acknowledgement of our common humanity. It wasn't much, just a nod, but somehow it felt good. So we'd get to the chapel, and there'd be an announcement, Buddhist meditation in chapel one, over the loudspeaker. It was pretty audible. And the guys would filter in rather gradually. So we didn't just start. That means there would be about 10 minutes for us to just chat informally with the inmates, most of whom had gotten to know because we go so often. And then the two volunteers would take turns doing the roles. So one person would lead a guided meditation, then the other person would lead give a Dharma talk. And then we'd both be there for Q&A. And then maybe, depending on the skills of the volunteers, end with Qigong, more rarely yoga, and then finally end up with a metta practice, which was always a good thing. Metta.
Metta.
Yes, metta practice. So, I'd always give the standard one. Think of someone that you know and like, and it's easy to think thoughts of. May you be happy, may you be free from inner and outer harm. And think of someone that's neutral and then have the same thought. And then think of someone that you know and really don't like, that you really would be just as happy or much happier if they were in another state, or in this case, in some other prison somewhere, and even though you don't want to say it, you say it anyway.
We'll do one at the end,
right? Oh, we can, yeah. May you be happy, may you be free from harm, and see what that feels like. And that would be the end. Pretty much the same routine every time. Now, Phil, would you like to describe the population?
Sure.
So our men. So there are four stages of security in prisons in California, going from the highest security at 4 down to minimum security of 1, and ours is 2, at least as far as I know.
Yes.
So the men that we see are all in for serious crimes. They've been in there for 20 to 30 years, so they're well-seasoned. The men we see are not, they're not the men that went in, right? They've grown old in prison. They're between 40 and 60 years old. We have a number of, I think mostly Latino, some Asian, a few black men, actually fewer than I would have expected, and then kind of a smattering of Caucasian men. Quite a number of them have very strong practice. They have a lot of time, and they have a lot of motivation, and so, but they vary quite widely. One man is just coming to mind. They've all been through some trauma, right? Usually quite a lot of trauma in their lives leading up to being in prison. And some of them have some real difficulty concentrating and sort of take the teachings and they modify them and use them as they're able. And which is humbling, right? It just brings to mind, at least for me, the fact that that I have capabilities, right? That we have our precious human life, and some human lives are less opportune. That's what I have for the description of the men. Did you want to go back, or get deeper into
how many people come on a typical Tuesday evening?
Yeah, so we have, and it kind of varies. It kind of swells and goes away, but it peaks out at about 20 men, 18 to 20 men. Quite a lot of them are regulars. They're not going anywhere. We get fewer during the end of basketball season.
Super Bowl.
Yeah, so we we do have a little bit of competition.
They do get to watch TV.
Yeah, they. Some of them come, I think, just for the quiet. So this is a period of time in their day when no one is yelling, there are no alarm bells going off, no one is telling them what to do. Doors are not being slammed in front of or behind them. They don't have to stand in line. They don't have to manage conflict. They can sit in a safe place and be quiet for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and that is a big deal for these people. And I think because of that, I experience a very strong sense of serenity in that chapel. I think we've talked about this, Bill, that you go in there and sit down and the men come and they're quiet, they're cowed, and they're really grateful that you're there, and they're really quiet, and they sit, and as they relish the quiet, I find that's quite contagious, and I find my whole being becoming more and more still, just in that initial meditation while we're there. Do you want me to talk about like a little bit more of the interactions that we have with them?
Yeah, great.
So we're not allowed to have individual relationships with the men. There are actually quite a lot of of rules in the prison. And it, basically the structure and intent of the rules is to is that we are providing a service on behalf of the prison to these men. So we are, to some extent, the face of an institution. We're not there primarily as individuals. We're not there to have individual relationships with the men. They caution us very strongly about being manipulated by the men. They're super good at it. They've had decades of practice. And those of us on the outside don't have decades of practice defending ourselves from that. So this is a game where we're very disadvantaged. So we keep our relationships very simple, and more or less platonic from our side. The men are, they express a lot of gratitude. They shake our hands. They thank us for being there. They're very polite.
Drive safely on your way home. They know we come a long way.
Yeah. And they, yeah, they're super nice. And sometimes they'll ask us if, you know, we can get a note to somebody in another yard.
Oh, you've had that.
Oh, yeah. We have female volunteers who get love notes. So we have these relationships with the men. But before and after the talks, they'll come up to us individually. They'll ask for advice. They'll want to talk about things. Sometimes those things are quite mundane. Sometimes they're pretty alarming. I had one man talk to me about his son who was in the hospital after having been stabbed by his girlfriend, worried that his son, right, who he can't see and hasn't seen for many years, is going to live. He did, so that's good. But there was a few weeks of knowing that this young man had been in the hospital. I didn't know anything more from that. So you get just a little smattering of that. Sometimes the men will talk about their crimes, just a little bit here and there, and dribs and drabs, sometimes during the program, sometimes afterwards. I would advise against killing another person. My experience, these men don't forget about it. They're not, it's not like way in the past. It's very present and poignant and fresh for them after 20, 30 years. Like they, and the prison isn't really set up to encourage forgetfulness. But these men, they carry a pretty heavy burden from their crimes. One of the men complained that he had written to the mother of his victim, and the mother had written him back and said that she forgave him, and he couldn't, he just couldn't understand that, and he was angry about it. He's like, I can't forgive myself. Like, how can she do this? It was as if she had taken a chunk of his story from him and left him without ground, right? Without his sense of self. So this is it's a population of a lot of need and a lot of dedication. There's one man who's in the SHU for...
SHU is...
Oh, the SHU. Oh, what does that stand for? It's solitary confinement.
Solitary housing unit.
Is it solitary? I thought it was...
Separate housing unit.
Something like that.
Is it SHU, separate housing?
Thank you. Yes.
So... And he was there for, I think he said 13 years. And he came to Buddhism because someone was leaving and giving away their books, and he happened to get a copy of the Dhammapada, kind of at random, and just read it and read it and read it and read it because that was the only thing he had to read. He has a very strong practice and a very, just a very strong, soothing presence. So his practice is amazing, amazing. You have some stories you want to tell?
Not stories exactly.
So when I was going, I never got those experiences you mentioned, being asked to pass notes to people in the other yard. That's quite verboten. So I never saw anything like that. And then the woman volunteer getting, shall we say, an appreciative note from one of them. I can't believe any woman would go to teach in a men's prison. It almost boggles my mind. If you want to maybe later chime in during Q&A, like what that's like, I'd like to hear it. But actually among the volunteers, it was about 50-50, half men, half women. I don't think I would be that brave. I used to tell people, if I talked about going in to do this, that all the guys, because they've been in prison for 20 or 30 years before they even find our meditation class, they've had the piss and vinegar burned out of them. They've had time to reflect. They've had time to decide they're going to change. And so they would, I would say, were invariably polite and well-spoken to us.
Into our group as well.
Yeah. And it's not quite true. It wasn't invariably. Now, there was like one guy that rubbed me the wrong way. I got kind of scared of him finally after 4 years. Needlessly, but I did. And then there were a couple guys who were just silent, sat in the back, almost never said anything, made me wonder, you know, are they enjoying this? Why do they show up every week? The rest of the guys, I look forward to seeing them. If they weren't there, I miss them. I felt a lot of love for them. And I know that I wasn't the only volunteer by any means who felt that way. Very touching experience. We're free. They're not. And yet, I thought we weren't so different. I never committed any of those crimes, but you know, as you look back over your life, or I find. I can think of thousands of things that I would have done differently. I think we all can. It's a matter of degree, not of kind. And, you know, I didn't grow up in an incredibly tough environment that they did. My parents were kind of clueless how to raise us, me and my siblings. And that, yes, it was hard for me. I had a lot to get through, going through my life. But my parents, nevertheless, were honest people with good values. And so I didn't grow up with anything like the trauma they did. You know, it's like, I was lucky. They weren't. Maybe that's the only difference. Being there in the room, in the chapel with them, I feel much more colorblind than I'd ever been in my life. You know, I just didn't even think about race. I kind of had to remind myself, oh yeah, what is the racial makeup here? And then I'd kind of count, just out of curiosity. Otherwise, I didn't notice or care. It's a little bit of an intense environment or thing that you were doing, so you're paying attention to the person, which was a wonderful thing.
And we were there to teach the Dharma. I've noticed just lately, I'm kind of taking it for granted lately, but for a long time, I knew it's the precious jewel. It's the thing that has overwhelmingly made the most difference in my life as far as happiness is concerned and understanding myself. And we are there to talk about love, compassion, generosity, letting go. It's as pure a subject matter as one can come up with. That's what we're talking about. And when do we ever, in the rest of our lives, or outside of this setting, get to talk about such things? So it's completely uplifting. And the guys, or the great majority of them, you can tell, are feeling the same thing. So as I said, driving home at night after this, it was an exhilarating feeling that would last for most of a week.
Not the least of which comes from they let us out.
No, that wasn't it for me, Phil. No, that wasn't the reason.
You get the sense at the end that, you know, they don't have to.
Yeah, that's... maybe the first time I went in. Yes, the first time I went in, am I going to be allowed to leave? Because there's quite a few barriers between the inside and the outside. After that first time, I'm going to say I didn't worry about
at
that.
At the very end,
yeah,
there's this fence.
There's this fence. It's in front of you. It's pretty wide, and so it's a long sidewalk that leads up to it, and there's this sally port in front of it, at the, you know, in the middle of it, and you're headed towards, and there's this guard tower, which I think is from way back from the 1930s, this big old white guard tower, and the guard in the tower controls the gate, and so you walk down this long sidewalk. The guard knows you're there the whole time, right? And you're walking down the sidewalk and you get to the end and the gate is still closed and you look up and you wave. And then, I don't know, I always kind of spend a little time hoping that that gate would actually open. And it's cold usually at night. So
there is a delay sometimes.
There is a delay. Which some people find disconcerting. But it is a great feeling. The men really appreciate it, and you're talking about the Dharma and applying the Dharma. The men during the Q&A, in my notes I have during the talk you teach Dharma of the mind, and during the Q&A you teach Dharma of the heart. The men talk about what's really happening for them and how they're feeling the threats from inside their minds and the threats from outside, and ask about how to reconcile that and how can it be safe to be compassionate. And so we talk about some very practical interpersonal issues that come up for these men and the struggles they go through in order to find a way of living that's congruent with the Dharma and also works in a prison environment. And they ask some really good hard questions. It's really cool. It's very challenging. And then on the way home, it's great to sort of decompress with my partner, and kind of go back through things. Oh, and then at the end, the other thing we do is we write up our experience. So we send out an email to our group, and then our little Sangha is part of a larger organization called BP3, and I forget what the...
Buddhist something prison project. I forget.
So that's kind of California-wide, I think.
Mostly Northern California.
Yeah, but we...
A little bit southern.
Yeah, we get emails from Southern California. So we share that experience with our community and with the broader community, and it helps us keep track of what the men are getting up to, what the next pair of people might encounter, rules changes at the prison, lockdowns situations. Sometimes we'll know in advance when the prison is going to be searched or there's a gang war going on, and so different parts of the population may or may not be able to come. Should we break for a Q&A?
I had one more thing to say, and then we're getting close to time, so no break, but just have a Q&A at the end.
All right, let's do it.
Yeah. So I want to put in
a plug for this novel. Don't read that many novels these days. I mostly like history. It has nothing to do with the prison. The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce. It's about a guy who's been pretty ineffective his whole life, and his marriage is ineffective. I mean, they don't hate each other, but it's kind of a cold war. They don't know how to talk to each other. One day he's on his way home, and at the fork to his house, he leaves it. He can't go in. He just starts walking from the extreme south of England to the extreme north to go find someone he hasn't seen in decades who's dying. And so that's his pilgrimage. And the reason I bring it up now is, reading this novel, I found myself seemingly remembering everything I had done in my life, seemingly, that I wished I hadn't done, and everything that I didn't do that I thought I should have done. It's a little unsettling. And of course, and this is why I bring it up, the guys in the prison, they don't have many distractions. There's not much to do sometimes except remember. And in case we haven't said it, it's mainly murder that everyone's in for. And I think it's great to remember all those things. Sometimes not easy, but, you know, like everything else, it depends on the attitude you bring to it. It doesn't have to be regret. It's just more like dependent origination, you know, the chain of cause and effect. Here's who I was then. Here's my conditioning. Here's how I reacted to my conditioning or to events based on conditioning.
And you see life as a great unfolding. With the Dharma, we gradually get to see ourselves, and maybe for the first time in our lives, we start to have something resembling free will. And so this act of remembering can become poignant and even kind of beautiful, even though it's hard. So I think we all have that in our lives. And yes, we have time. Q&A? Anyone? Anything? Ask anything. Yes, Christy.
What made you start doing this? What motivated you?
Okay. I work as an architectural historian, mainly on San Francisco history and architecture. And one of the characters I researched many years ago was a Swedenborgian minister, late 19th century, early 20th century, named Joseph Worster. And besides his being a preacher, he did some things on the side that were nice, pretty cool, including mentoring ex-prisoners, bringing them to his home. And I thought, could I? I mean, that's great. I admire him, but could I do that? So flash forward decades, and I'm at IMC at a volunteer fair, and there's a woman who's staffing her table, and it's about going into CTF, our prison, correctional training facility. And with Joseph Worster in my mind, I asked her a few questions, and I said, I'll think about it. And she said, oh, listen, I will contact you. Almost no one wants to do this. Anyone who shows interest and has some experience under their belt, I will get back to you. It's kind of like I couldn't say no, Christy. And I was doing it for Joseph Worster. You want to answer that?
Sure. So, after I'd been practicing for just a couple of years, I was at a place where I wanted to deepen my practice, and I understood that doing service was a way to do that. So I was kind of looking for an opportunity to do service, and then Bill showed up at the IMC one Sunday morning and said, "Hey, we need more volunteers at this prison thing that I'm doing." And kind of like Bill, I showed just the slightest amount of interest, and was immediately embraced by our little sangha. So I kind of just did it. I just tried it, and that was 5 years ago, four or five years ago. Yeah, it's been a long time. Yeah, yeah. Any more?
Yes.
Did anyone talk about getting released and life outside and what they learned from meditation and helping them adjust to life outside, or any reflection?
I don't have as good an answer to that as I would like to be able to give you, but you want to start?
Sure. Yeah. So one of the interesting things that happens with us is we aren't allowed to know the prisoners once they get out. That's part of the deal, and then the purpose is to break chains of communications that gangs or whatever might use to cause trouble from or within the prison. If you go to IMC regularly, you may have encountered Jacques Verdun. Yes, he runs a program called GRIP, and in that program, the men do come out and can continue to be active in that community and become Some of them actually become teachers and go back into the prisons to teach the other men, which is quite it's quite a stirring set of stories to hear when Jacques brings them. So there is some of that. It is, of course, quite difficult to be a returning citizen, as what we call them, from prison. There's a more or less inadequate system of halfway houses and other supports for them. Cindy? Okay, so I've been going, like I said, for 4 or 5 years. We do see the same men. Well, there's a core group of men that we see every time. And yes, there's one in particular who was quite the personality. He knows a lot of Buddhism, and he has his own quite austere practice that he holds very tightly, and he has had very strong opinions about how we should be teaching the class and what we should be teaching, and he wanted us to bring in an altar, which was not a very practical thing for us to do, and was kind of generally disruptive. And it's interesting that he, of all people, has really shown a lot of visible progress. I think he's gotten feedback, so and he's taken it to heart. He really honestly wants his practice to be very, very good and very strong. And there's a story about a novice monk asking the abbot, how long will it take to be enlightened? And the abbot saying, oh, you know, maybe a year. And the monk saying, well, what if I work really, really hard? And the abbot says, oh, well, maybe for you, 2 years. And the monk says, no, you don't understand. I am very determined, and I will work really, really hard. And the abbot says, it might take you 10 years. But yeah, this particular prisoner, he's loosening his grip, and it's really great to see, and it's great to see some of those same strong aspects of his personality coming out in different, more gentle ways.
So we're running a few minutes over, but I did want to also chime in on your question. Yes, we usually don't know how the guys are getting along after they're released, and quite a few of the inmates that I knew would get paroled or just released over the years. I did hear about one fella who was one of my favorites, Asian fella, and he was paroled in his 50s, and he got a job doing heavy manual labor, which was not easy for him. But as I understood from a friend of his, African American fellow who's still in the prison, and who had been friends, but he was glad to have it, so he wasn't going to complain. He was a pretty strong guy. But I should. There's a good and bad. There's a good and bad to this. At this particular prison, there were a lot of programs, so tons and tons of Christian programs. One Buddhist, one Muslim, Native American, AA, and all kinds of things I don't know about. And I asked one of our fellows who They all have jobs in the prison. And he had kind of an administrative job, or kind of guiding other new inmates in the right direction. So how many people in this prison of like 3,000 people go to a program of some kind or other? And, you know, a good program, an uplifting one. And he said, well, I think it's, he said 50 to 60%. So that's most, and that's good. But then once they're released, I don't think there's any support, guidance, greasing the skids for them to get jobs, much help in any way. I think it must be tough for someone who's been in prison for decades to find his way through society. It's too bad.
We should wrap it up.
Yeah, we're a little over. I hope this has been of interest to you. Thank you all for being here. Thanks for your questions. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.